When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Welcome to this week's episode of the Elise Glink Show. I'm your host, Elise Glink, and I am here to help you make, hopefully, very smart choices about your financial life. First, as always, here's my Glinkonomics report for the week. Pending home sales continued a four-month climb in April, reaching the highest level since May of 2006. That's right, middle of the aughts. That takes us back, count them, 9 years to a time before the housing market actually crashed. I'm Elise Glink. Here's today's Real Estate Minute. The National Association of Realtors Pending Home Sales Index rose almost 3.5% from March, 14% from April of last year. The Pending Sales Index is a leading housing market indicator that measures the number of existing homes for sale with signed purchase contracts that have yet to go to closing. Now, for obvious reasons, analysts use this index to gauge how many existing homes will be sold in the months ahead. And although there are several possible causes for a contract to be canceled, right, like a home doesn't appraise out in value, generally they lead to closings, and these closings typically take 1 to 2 months. However, April marked a bit of a departure from business as usual, shall we say, as existing home sales dropped despite the PHSI having risen in each of the prior several months. Most analysts seemed inclined to believe that the disparity of April was an anomaly, and the relationship between the PHSI and upcoming existing home sale numbers will remain intact. We'll see. I'll be keeping an eye on next month's figures from the National Association of Realtors, just to be sure. All righty, let's get on with the rest of today's show. I've got two guests with me today. First, I'll talk with Gino Blafari, who's the CEO of HSF Affiliates. They manage some pretty great brands like Berkshire Hathaway Home Services and Prudential. He's coming on the show to discuss some of the big moves Berkshire's been making in the real estate business, as well as the results of their first quarter homeowner sentiment survey. And there's some cool stuff on millennials in there as well. Then we're going to hear all about the risks of occupancy fraud from Tim Coyle, who's Senior Director of Financial Services and Global Real Estate at LexisNexis. He's the co-author of LexisNexis's annual mortgage fraud report. And what's so interesting about this is how few people really understand when they're committing occupancy fraud. And I think you're going to get a lot out of this interview. I know I did. Then for the last treat, I have a report on just how difficult it can be for college graduates to find affordable apartments when they move into a big metro area to start a new job. Rental problems are abounding, folks, and we're going to keep covering it for you. All right, that's this week's lineup. Let's get started. So if you've looked out at any neighborhood that you happen to be driving through, you might be seeing a Berkshire Hathaway sign. Berkshire Hathaway has taken over by leaps and bounds in the real estate industry over the last couple of years. They are buying up affiliates all over the country, and they've formed HSF Affiliates. So that operates Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, which includes a couple of other big brands, including Prudential. Gino Blafari is the CEO of HSF Affiliates, and I invited him on the show to talk a little bit about Berkshire Hathaway's runaway growth as a company. It's kind of come out of nowhere, and they have a huge number of agents. And also, they have a first quarter homeowner sentiment survey that showed some interesting trends on how people are defining the concept of home value. The big headline for the survey seems to be that price and location are no longer the only motivating factors when choosing a home to buy. And there's a new sense that homeowners and homebuyers are looking at their homes as longer-term investments that will shape and be shaped by how they live. That's kind of interesting. So I wanted to welcome to the show Gino Blafari, CEO of HSF Affiliates, operators of Berkshire Hathaway Home Services. Gino, welcome to Big Money Real Estate.
Thanks. Great to be here. Thank you for having me on.
Sure. So just when we were off camera, you were starting to tell me a little bit about how you got involved with Berkshire Hathaway. Tell me about your background and then how you got pulled in as the CEO.
Okay. Well, longtime real estate guy. Had a couple of independent companies that I've actually sold. Done it twice now. Had a company called Contempo Realty, which in 1997 sold to Realogy. And was with Realogy for 5 years because I had a five-year non-compete. When that was up, I founded Intero Real Estate Services right here in Silicon Valley. And just last year, I was offered the position of CEO of HSF Affiliates, which operates the brands Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Prudential, and Real Living.
So tell me how many brokers and agents you now have working under this brand.
Okay, under Berkshire.
Well, I know it's several. It's several brands. It's Prudential as well.
Yeah, several brands. But we'll start with the Berkshire Hathaway Home Services brand because the last year was a year of conversion. We were converting many of the Prudential real estate companies to Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, and as of like today, we have over 37,000 real estate agents and almost 1,200 offices all converted. That was last year. At 2015 and going forward now is a transition from conversion to growth.
All right. So did you say 37,000 agents?
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
Are those congregated in major metropolitan areas or have you spread into more of the second tier cities? Where are you?
We are all over. We're in 47 of the states right now, but we're just about our footprint is in the metropolitan areas, but also all across the country.
Where does the impetus come from Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway? This idea that you're going to take on Realogy and the established big brands. Why did you and why does he feel that there's room for this? And clearly there is because you've built yet another brand, and I really thought that once Better Homes and Gardens Real Estate launched, that was the last big brand we were going to see. But this brand has really come in and taken, I think, the industry by storm.
Yeah, you know, I think it's just normal to our industry. There'll be more brands after this brand that comes in, and it's just the nature of real estate. The nice thing about starting a brand from scratch is you can start from scratch, much the way I did with Intero Real Estate Services, starting from scratch.
So when you're actually thinking about moving ahead and growth plans over this year and next year, what are some of the things that you're looking to do? Are you looking to add on those last three states? Are you looking to double the number of brokers? I mean, you've got out of 37,000, there are roughly a million two, depending on who you talk to, agents out there. So it's a small percentage of what is potentially and what is an enormous pie. What's the strategy for growth?
Well, here's a strategy. My assignment basically is to grow the network, and I like to call that the war. So the war is to grow the network, and then the four battles that I've chosen to fight to win the war is per person productivity, which is kind of interesting because typically a franchisor never really pushes down to the per person productivity of an agent. Okay. The next thing I have is average sales price. With the Berkshire Hathaway Home Services name and brand, we're a natural fit to the high end. The other piece where I can, being a past broker and operator, I can help the existing companies grow organically through recruiting agents, also through mergers and acquisitions. And then the fourth piece or the fourth battle to win the war would be selling franchises, new affiliates in areas that we aren't in. We'll be extra careful on who we choose to award a franchise to. But those are the four things.
And are you hoping for what kind of growth over the next 2-3 years?
I'm hoping to grow by, 10% each year.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's going to add up, that's for sure. Well, let's talk a little. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry. To that point, if we can organically grow the existing companies, okay, I'd love, and it's a very, very, hairy, audacious goal to steal a line from Jim Collins. I'd love to help every one of our existing affiliates double the size of their company within the next 3 years.
And that would actually be enormously profitable for you up at the very top.
Yes. I mean, you can think of, when you have probably, let's just pretend, use the number 50,000 agents. If you increase per person productivity by one transaction per agent, okay, that's a huge jump there. And my goal is to increase per person productivity by one transaction per quarter.
Wow. That will be really interesting to see, and we'll definitely track it for you. Not that you're not tracking, but for those of us playing at home. Let's turn and talk about your survey a little bit. You did a survey of something like almost 2,100 homeowners and 500 prospective homebuyers in February. You covered seven themes: the smart term long investment, the fits needs now and in the future, ease of purchase decision, the makes me feel proud location and community, benefit the entire family, opportunity create. And you kind of came up with some interesting themes about how millennials and other people who are out there today take a look and value home buyers. So what did you find in this survey?
You know, it wasn't too tremendously surprising to me, being, you know, an agent since 1985 and an operator up until last year. But here's what we found. Millennials are very much interested in ease of purchase. How can they get into the home? And it was also very, very important to a millennial to be able to say that they owned a home. Those were two things that jumped out to me, where the Gen Xers and the boomers, of which I'm a boomer, they were more looking at home as an investment, okay? You know, you're the biggest investment that you would make, and the importance of it being as an investment.
So this is more, you think, for millennials, this is really about a home is a home. Is that not thinking about it, though, in the right way? You pour so much money into this. How do you make a smart decision about whether owning a home is the right move or renting a home is a better move if you're not actually looking at the metrics and the numbers? And if we know anything about millennials, we know that they definitely understand metrics, or at least about social media metrics.
Yeah, you know, and I think a millennial will understand that their parents, who are the baby boomers and the Gen Xers, certainly have built up a great deal of wealth by owning their home. And so that's a piece. And not to mention, we got other factors going for us right now with pretty much appreciation throughout the country, much higher in certain areas than other areas, but also these incredibly low interest rates that we have that make home buying a great deal for anybody buying opposed to renting.
So if millennials are valuing the now over the future, what does now look like to them? Is now 2 or 3 years? Is now 6 months? Has that definition of sort of now taken over and people just aren't even thinking about the future?
Yeah, well, for our survey, the now is anybody thinking to purchase in the next 6 months. Okay, so that was our very current thing. I've talked to many millennials, and they also still understand the investment of home ownership. You know, here's an interesting thing: when the baby boomers were the same age as the millennials, 18 to 35. Okay, you know what we thought of me as a baby boomer? The ease of purchase. We thought of the exact same things. It's almost more of a an age thing than it is different demographics of being a millennial, being a Gen Xer, or being a baby boomer. Certainly these millennials, they're digital natives, okay? So they've got all sorts of access to stuff, but that would be my thought.
It's sort of interesting. We all thought about ease of purchase, but it wasn't very easy for us. It's a whole lot easier today to find out all kinds of information about homes and the history of them, and the web has certainly changed how that is. But one of the other things that I thought was interesting about your survey is it talked about how 88% of current homeowners say it's important to update or renovate their home over time. 75% have done renovations to their current homes. And then, well, of course, because the first thing that happens when you typically move into a house is you spend an average of $10,000 to $15,000 to update, renovate, put in window treatments, new carpet, polish your wood floors, new kitchen cabinets. But is there something else beyond that that you found in this survey?
That's an interesting point. Yeah, here's what we did find. You know, they always talk about, you know, kitchen and bathrooms, and probably bathrooms ahead of kitchens, because kitchens are so personal and people like to have a kitchen the certain way. But here's what we found in the survey, that over 60% were all talking green, you know, green upgrades, appliances that are green, solar, dual pane windows. Green happened to be a big deal, which was actually great to see.
It is great to see. Over the last 7 years, green has really gone from one of those things that all retailers and manufacturers said, is that actually a real thing or just sort of a longer-term thing? And I did some consulting with companies, including HGTV and then some of the actual home products manufacturers. So, Gino, it seems like it has been, 25 years of my whole career that I've been hearing about how we're going to get a connected home, a greener home, and all the rest. I'm wondering if your agents are actually now going into homes and seeing the vision of Nest, which is to have that kind of connected Google hardware and software that actually goes together to make the home greener, more eco-friendly, and the rest.
You know, let me just speak a couple things about green. In 2006, I was actually the eco broker of the year for green, okay? And I remember my daughter was about 16, and I purchased a little hybrid car, and I actually got the California license plate eco broker. But I can remember all my managers at Intero thought I had lost it. Like, what is he doing on this green thing? Okay, and then over time, it became more and more clear. So to that point, it is. I was just meeting with one of the agents that's in a book club that I'm in, and he was telling me a story about green that he recently in Silicon Valley, where prices are high. We've got Google, we've got Tesla, you name it, we have them here in Silicon Valley. He sold a lot to a customer for $3.5 million in Los Altos Hills. And the big thing about this customer was he wanted to be totally off the grid. So he wants to be able to be completely off the grid. So it is out there, and it will be more and more and more.
So interesting. Thanks, Gino. Gino Blefari is the CEO of HSF Affiliates in Irvine, and they own the brands Berkshire Hathaway and Prudential. And what was the third?
Real Living.
And Real Living, wow. Thank you so much for being with us. This has just been a great interview.
Great. It's great to be with you, too.
Do you know what mortgage fraud is? You may not, and you may be committing it without having any idea. Today's guest has some information about that, and there's good news and bad news associated with what's going on with mortgage fraud today. The good news first, appraisal fraud has been curtailed somewhat in recent years, thanks to some government regulation. The bad news is that occupancy application fraud is on the rise. Tim Coyle is the Senior Director of Financial Services and Global Real Estate for the Risk Solutions business of LexisNexis. And he's got numbers on why banks still have their work cut out for them when it comes to occupancy mortgage fraud. And I want to define for you exactly what that is. Tim, welcome to Big Money Real Estate.
Hey, Elise. Thanks for having me on the show.
Sure. Let's start with a big definition. Tell us what happens when mortgage occupancy fraud happens.
Sure. Occupancy fraud is generally when you are trying to take ownership of a home. You're trying to, a lot of times what we'll call it is you've got fraud for housing or fraud for occupancy, and you also have fraud for profit. A lot of times this is classified fraud for occupancy. And what that means is you generally don't intend to default on that loan, but because it's a second home or investment property, obviously the risk could go up there as well. So let me kind of just define it for you if I can just
Please.
Take a minute. So you've got, when you're taking a loan application, when you're doing a Fannie Mae 1003, which is a loan application, you're sitting down with your loan officer and they're asking you, is this a primary residence? They're asking you if it's three types. Is it a primary residence, number one? Is it a second home or an investment property? At the second that you sign a document and you have on there that this is a primary residence and you intend to have this as an investment property, you have now committed mortgage fraud at that time.
So let me jump in and say to people that if you read the documents carefully, what you say when you sign this, I believe it still says this, that you intend to live in it or you will live in it for 1 year from the date of closing, or you have the intention to live in it. Is that correct still?
Correct. You will live in that house. You'll occupy it 60 to 90 days after, and you'll live in that house for 1 year.
Right. Although there
so
is...
even at that point in time, if you do occupy that house, and let's say it's 8 to 9 months down the road, and you want to put it in investment make it an investment property, you should at that point in time call up your lender and let them know what's your intent, because you're really, at that point in time, you're breaking your contract with that lender.
Right. Whereas if you let it go to 1 year, you would not be.
Correct.
Right.
Because that's what you're signing for. So again, and go ahead. Sorry, Lise.
Well, what I was going to say, just to be really clear for everybody watching, it's this intention to occupy it. If you are, you close on the home and suddenly about 2 minutes after you close on the home, your company transfers you surprisingly to, say, San Francisco, and you're supposed to be living in Ohio,
right.
The intention is still there. But if you go into this property thinking to yourself, I already live in a beautiful house and I'm going to buy this 6 miles away and I know I'm going to be renting this property out, whether it's a house or a condo or whatever it is, that's occupancy fraud. If you have
Correct.
Signed the mortgage as an owner-occupied unit, but you fully intend to just rent it out from day one.
Correct. Absolutely.
What percentage of people are doing that?
So on Fannie Mae's recent file that we just looked at, they had a 19% of all mortgage fraud was occupancy fraud. But the problem with that is, and I think at the beginning of this, you alluded to a few of these appraisal fraud going down. But the problem with occupancy fraud is it's on the rise. A lot of fraud is going down right now. It's decreasing. And the regulators have done a great job in some areas. So if you kind of look at what happened with Dodd-Frank and call it post-crash 2007, what happened was they put in a lot of new regulations. And a lot of that was for, if you remember, appraisal fraud was big time.
Sure.
It was pervasive. What used to happen was the loan officer would order the appraisal. And that's a conflict of interest because the loan officer has a lot to gain from that appraisal coming back at the right price, correct?
Absolutely.
So what happens is, you know, in that instance, what they did is in 2010, they mandated that you must now use an appraisal management company. A loan officer is no longer allowed to order your appraisal, nor is the loan officer allowed to discuss your appraisal with the appraiser. It has to be run through an appraisal management company, which is a third-party vendor, and generally they have a round robin of lots of different appraisers on staff. That was a great rule. They got that right. They really did. I mean, I think it was fantastic. Very similar to what they did with the 4506 on the 4506T on the income documentation. If you remember, another law that I believe they got right was people would go out and sign a 4506 form when you do a loan. If anybody's gotten a loan recently, you're familiar with this. It gives the lender the right to go and pull your income statements from the IRS,
right.
And your income, your tax transcripts, so they can see exactly what you're making. So if you say, I made $40,000 last year, and in fact, you made $20,000, well, if you pull a 4506T, by signing the 4506T, if you pull that through the IRS, you can validate that, okay? What they used to do is, before a lot of this regulation went in, you would just sign a 4506. And nobody would actually validate it. Nobody actually would pull that form.
Yeah.
Okay.
The verifications were a little bit lacking, shall we say?
Well, and that's exactly what I'm going at. So if you look at what's being done today, somebody's basically kind of like what I equate to is the old 4506. You just said, hey, I make $100,000, and I'm in a first level job that's making really 20, but I just signed it and they took my word for it.
Right.
Okay.
Stated income.
That was the old way. And then once they actually started validating and pulling those transcripts, you could obviously see fraud or some sort of misrepresentation. Maybe the person got it wrong, but at least you could actually validate whether or not that was true. Similar to with occupancy, if you say, hey, my intent is to occupy this house as my primary residence, and to your point, I've got a five-bedroom, four-bath home 5 miles from this condo property that is one-fifth the price, one that doesn't add up, but then I sign something and say, no, that's what I intend to do. Well, if you don't go back in and pull something 90 days later to make sure that person's occupying that property, you're really failing at your job. I mean, you've got to go back and do that. You have to go back and make sure that these people are, in fact, moving into their house.
So,
otherwise, you're putting more risk on your books by allowing somebody to have a second home or an investment property on the bank's books that normally wouldn't be there. They'd be a primary residence. And
right.
and if they were investment or second, they would require more money down and a higher interest rate to in fact, uh, really to to go hand in hand with the amount of risk that you're right. taking. So again, it might be 50 basis points, it might be 100 basis points, but it is more when you get an investment property or a second home.
All right, so that of course is exactly why people do this. They feel like the risk reward is much greater. So if you buy an investment property, typically you're still required to put down between 25 and 35% in cash. Long gone are the days of zero down, nothing down, you know, all that kind of baloney, to
absolutely.
Put a nice word on, right?
No,
I'm not
absolutely.
Sure that was ever really true. But and then on top of that, you're paying extra fees. Usually you may be paying as much as 5% in fees, 3 to 5%. And then on top of that, your interest rate is going to be a half a point to a point higher, depending on what your credit score looks like. And so
right.
that's a significant amount of cash for an investment property over and above what you were doing before. And people who have, like the big hedge funds who have all come in, they're buying with cash. They have a lot of cash out there that's right. earning zero. They're plugging it in here, and if they get a 5 or an 8 or a 10% return, they're doing much better than having cash sitting in a bank. But for the average, let's say, less flush investor,
right. sure.
you know, they have to actually get a mortgage on that, and it's a lot cheaper to get a mortgage with 3% down at 3.5%, 4%. Than it is to put 35% down, which you may not even have. On top of that, you have to have more cash in the bank, and then, you know, all the rest as it goes along. So it's easy to understand why you might see 36%, you know, higher occupancy right. fraud than you did the last time anybody looked.
Right. And again, there's no real checks in place. There's no one consistent methodology that's in place today to check for occupancy fraud.
Well, how are they doing it now? What are they doing? Are they knocking on doors?
So that's actually a great question. It's a very, very expensive one. Refinance right now, the probably the best process is to go knock in the traditional sources is to go knock on a door and find out if that person really is living there or not. But that's very, very expensive. I mean, that can be anywhere from $100 to $250 to have somebody go knock on your door. Also, do you really want some person knocking on your door and with all of the
that doesn't work too well when the lenders have gone knocking on people's doors trying to get them to answer their phone or open their mail or, you know, answer the door. You know, nobody wants to do that to a lender.
Right. And how do you even know? I mean, how does this third party really even know who Tim Coyle is?
There's no way to know.
Tim Coyle could be my son or my brother or my, you know, whoever, my uncle. That's living there.
So what are they doing? Are they checking, I guess they could check tax records, they could check against driver's licenses to see if that's switched. What are they doing?
Absolutely. And again, with the cost of compliance being so high right now, you know, the banks and the mortgage companies are trying to do everything they possibly can to really comply with all the new regulation out there and with Dodd-Frank. I really think everybody's trying to do everything they can. Unfortunately, right now, you don't have, well, I should say up until now, you don't really have one single source, one consistent methodology. Somebody might use motor vehicle registrations. Somebody might use DMV records. Somebody else, to your point, might use tax assessors. But again, unless you can pull all that to one, which is, you know, the product that we just came out with here at LexisNexis Risk Solutions is a new verification of occupancy that kind of brings all of those dimensions, brings 16 different dimensions into one. And you can look at, it's consistent. And you can look at, 16 different dimensions of that person to see if that person does occupy that house or not. And if they don't, it actually will let you know who actually is occupying it as well.
That's so interesting. So what are some of the things that you look at of the 16?
Well, and again, I mean, just some of them I could probably mention is motor vehicle, utilities, tax assessor,
right.
DMV records. As you know, here at Lexis, we have, you know, billions of...
You have lots of information on all of us. I know, you're like a credit reporting bureau. You have lots and lots of details.
we certainly do. And, you know, we certainly hope that we're using that to stop fraud, to put an end to fraud.
Right.
That's really what we're in the business to do. So when the lenders kind of came to us with their problem this past year and a half is, hey, we just don't have a way to really check for occupancy. We want to stop it. We'd like to stop it. Could you help us stop it? So that's when we actually said, yes, you know, let us look at this. Let's look into it. And we built this product called Verification of Occupancy that brings all those together and it scores it out. So it'll be anywhere from a 0 to a 90, you know, kind of help that lender identify whether or not that person does occupy that property.
How accurate is it, do you think?
Well,
I mean, I'm sure you've tested
question.
It.
So we did one recent side-by-side study on 7,000 loans of good knowns and good bads. Okay, mm-hmm. the traditional way. It was a study, a side-by-side study with a very large financial institution that I can't obviously name their name, but a very large financial institution doing a side-by-side study on 7,000 loans. We were able to predict 2.6 times the amount of mortgage fraud on that file that they were using this new occupancy fraud product that we've come up with.
That's pretty significant, I would think, because what are they normally able to do it? I mean, it seems like that they would have the ability to catch a very small percentage of this.
Yeah, and that's, you know, in this study, they had 113 records that they were able to, and we were 290 again, which is about 2.6 times the amount.
Right. But still a fraction of what it actually is.
Oh yeah, and then that's of true confirmed mortgage fraud. So,
okay.
Most of the 7,000 records were good. I mean, you hope out of somebody's portfolio that most of it is good. So, but we were able to find that extra, 2.6 times the amount of mortgage fraud, which ultimately came back to $40 million in unnecessary repurchase demands that would be pushed back on that lender.
So let's be really clear what happens here. So if you commit mortgage occupancy fraud, so in other words, you buy this property and you have no intention of living there, which is a burden of proof, and you've rented it out, and the lender comes back, they can call your loan. I mean,
absolutely.
That's what happens. They could call your loan. They could press charges against you and go even more, which would be, I think, kind of dumb because then nobody's paying the mortgage. But that's another story. I mean, fraud is fraud, and there could be some legal options against you as well if you're committing that.
Well, and again, if they call that note due and nobody can get another loan at that point because they didn't have the true 30%, guess what's going to happen?
Right.
They're going to get foreclosed on, and now all of a sudden you're having a foreclosure on your record. So even if they don't press charges on you, you're now going to have a foreclosure that was unexpected. And you could have had an investor in there, and it could be paying on time. I think, Elise, I think you bring up a great scenario that a lot of people don't think about, and that is most people think that the only time I can get in trouble for fraud is if it goes bad.
Right.
That's not the case here.
It's not the case, but I can't imagine lenders really want, 20% of their loan portfolio going into foreclosure simply because these people didn't, committed loan occupancy fraud. There has to be another remedy for them. I'm not sure whether that's buying another title policy, if that's getting more money put down, getting more of the loan paid off. There has to be some sort of other remedy than taking 20% of your portfolio into foreclosure.
Well, and
that just isn't smart anyway.
Right. And don't forget, let me make sure I clarify, on the 20% of all, when the Fannie Mae study is 20% of all mortgage fraud is occupancy fraud. So it wouldn't be that. It wouldn't be represented.
Oh, okay.
That
so that's better because I'm thinking, that's a lot of mortgage fraud.
No, but to your point on that 7,000 portfolio study that we conducted, I mean, you were still talking about $60 million of occupancy fraud on a 7,000 loan portfolio.
It's
so
not
that's
a small
still
number.
A ton of money. I mean, enough to really put anybody in jeopardy, especially any sort of bank. So it's a large problem. And again, I'd say the biggest concern that I have about occupancy fraud is that why I think we've done a great job with some of the appraisals, some of the income docs, again, that I've mentioned before. This is the one that's up. I mean, it's up 36% from 2011 to now, to 2014.
Do you think
36%.
Well, rising 36% is huge. I'm trying to think if this is because the investors who are doing this, that they are, and we're not talking about somebody who buys the house and then a month into it, they get transferred somewhere else. That's, no bank is going to call you on that. Again, this is about intent. So they have to prove you never intended to live there.
Right. But and generally on that one, the lender would probably just ask that borrower to get a transfer, some information from that his or her company stating that that person's being relocated.
Yeah.
And that company would be happy to comply. And generally at that point in time, too, the person would usually put their house in the market, and you could actually pull an MLS to confirm that that person is selling that and that is true. But lenders aren't looking to stick it to people, and they're you know, but they are looking to, and we are looking to put an end to fraud.
Right, which is so interesting, Tim. This has been really insightful, and I appreciate it. And I hope you'll come back, and we'll talk about some other kinds of real estate mortgage fraud that are out there.
Yeah, Elise, as always, thanks for having us on the show. We appreciate it.
Probably not going to make much money in your first job out of school, but you are going to need to be able to afford a place to live. And I'm guessing you're hoping it isn't going to be your parents' basement. They're probably hoping the same thing, by the way. I'm Elise Glink. Here's today's Real Estate Minute. Housing economist Ralph McLaughlin over at Trulia just published a really interesting analysis on rental affordability for new grads in the 25 largest U.S. metro areas. And I wanted to share a few of the highlights of it. If you're interested in learning more, the full report is available from a link below this video. Trulia's analysis uses median income for employed college grads between the ages of 22 and 25, which varies by city, and calculates what percentage of rental properties in each metro area can be leased with renter's insurance for just 31% of that median monthly income or less. Now remember, 31% is pretty close to the new normal amount. People are spending a proportion of their income on rent these days. And that's kind of bad news unto itself. In St. Louis, which ranked among the most affordable cities for recent grads, the maximum affordable rent is just $666. That means that under 20% of the St. Louis rental market is available to graduates making a median income there. Can't find much to rent. Dallas is the second most affordable city on the list, and it has a maximum affordable rent of $799, call it $800, meaning median income for new grads is higher there than in St. Louis, and less than 15% of the rental market is available at or below that price point. So again, not many places to rent. Once you fall out of the top three most affordable markets for recent grads, Houston is number three. Less than 10% of each market is considered affordable by the 31% standard. That kind of gets scary, right? In Portland, Oregon, which is the least affordable market in the study, really, Portland, grads can only afford a monthly rent of $479 because there's really low median income earnings. Unsurprisingly, very few units are available to be rented at that price point. In fact, it's only 1/10 of 1% of the market. So good luck finding one of those properties. And if you do, are you going to want to really live there? In San Francisco, where the median rent is currently $3,500 per month, and a friend of my son's is spending the summer renting a place that costs $7,000 a month, a recent grad would need to earn more than $137,000 a year to be able to afford that price. Although recent grads in San Francisco earn a really good amount, it's about a median amount of $41,000 a year, that's only enough to give them access to about, well, less than 4% of the market. Here's what scares me the most when I think about these statistics. Trulia's analysis doesn't even factor in crushing student debt that many graduates are facing once they hit the real world. When you consider that the class of 2015 will graduate with an average debt of more than $35,000, that's college debt, not everything they have on top of college debt, which a lot of them do, like auto loans and credit card debt. But when you factor it in and you have just school debt of $35,000 apiece, spending 31% of their first paycheck, gross monthly income, on rent seems a little bit optimistic. I hope you enjoyed today's episode, and as always, I want to give a big thank you to my guests for all their incredible information. If there was anything you missed, don't worry. You can find the show notes to this episode at thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com, and we'll have links to everybody and all their information. Also, if you're new to the show, please subscribe. And if you're a regular listener and haven't already done so, please consider giving this show a rating and/or a review in iTunes. You can do it by searching for the Elise Glink Show in the podcast section of iTunes, and this helps the show get discovered by new people. You can also forward it to all your friends, and I hope you do that too. This brings us to the end of another episode of the Elise Glink Show. I'm your host, Elise Glink, and I'll be back next week with another episode. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great week.